This is Overdrive on TSN 1050, the voice of Toronto sports.
Scott MacArthur, Steve Simmons, it's Overdrive on TSN 1050, and you're streaming us on the TSN Go app. Wayne Drays of ESPN The Magazine to talk Steve Bartman half an hour from now. But as we discussed in the last hour, the brand new, relatively brand new, commissioner of the CFL, Randy Ambrosi, has been a busy man today. The CFL announcing a significant in-season rule change. Each coach, each team will be limited to one play call challenge per game for the remainder of this year and going forward. And we're pleased to be joined on the Maple Toyota Hotline by the commissioner of the CFL, Randy Ambrosi. Thanks for taking some time, Randy. How are you today?
Well, I'm great, and I'd like to join a segment that starts with AC/DC, so that's a real bonus.
There you go. It's almost like Malls was in your mind there. So you've been at this now, what? Steve and I were talking a little bit more than a month between Karen and some significant rule changes here. You've been a busy man.
Yeah, it has been busy, but I'm enjoying it. I've met a lot of great people, and I have a much better feel for the opportunity, and today was a busy day, but another rewarding one.
So you've made a significant change today, and it's not often we'll see something like this in the middle of a season for any professional league. What A, prompted the change, and B, prompted it to happen now?
Well, I'd been watching this for some time, certainly well before becoming commissioner, and it was a concern to me that the challenge flags were coming fast and furious. When I went back and asked for the historical rationale for the challenge flag program and how it's evolved over time, it was ultimately put in place to correct the egregious mistake, the one that would cost the team a game. You think about that moment where we'd be watching a Grey Cup or an Eastern or Western final and a official would miss something and it would cost the team the outcome of the game, and it was designed to prevent that from happening. And what had happened with the way the program had evolved is coaches had a ditty bag of challenge flags, and I think what they were to some degree doing is using them to look for an opportunity to extend a drive, and they were in fact I don't think they were honoring the spirit of the original intent. Coaches, as you know, are very creative guys, and they want to win. And so I think when we started having the conversation amongst a wide universe of people, it became obvious that we had gotten away from the intent. And I've gotten a lot of fan feedback. I've visited 8 of the 9 stadiums so far, and a lot of fans, pulled me aside and they love the game, but they said, "Randy, this just doesn't work for us. This is taking away from the enjoyment of the game." And I thought that, well, okay, that's it. We need to look at it. And I was that's what started the process.
With CFL Commissioner Randy Ambrosi on Overdrive, TSN 1050, and the TSN Go app, Steve and I were talking last hour, Randy, about the notion of subjectivity. And so, on one hand, I appreciate the foresight of the Canadian Football League willing to allow coaches to challenge penalty calls like pass interference. But on the other hand, I have a hesitation where you're lumping more subjectivity on top of the original subjectivity. So, which is to say, if an official calls pass interference, you can challenge that. Or if he doesn't call pass interference, you can challenge that, and it can be overruled. But it's somebody else's subjectivity overturning the official's subjectivity. Whereas there are objective calls. Was that a fumble? Was that a catch or not? Does that concern you at all? The fact that a play like that, which can change so much a game, and we've seen it even in the Grey Cup, comes down to subjectivity lumped on to more subjectivity.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I suppose the honest answer is subjectivity is a part of the human condition. And the fact is, I don't see a day when, you know, we are effectively, could we be officiated by computers that will catch everything? And the game would be absolutely perfect. Well, the problem is that the players aren't, you know, the players are human, and players and coaches make mistakes, and officials make them as well. I think this thing is they're trying to get that moment where there is a game-changing mistake made, and then hopefully the video review will catch it, and then we'll get back on track. You know, I often think of, you know, that pitcher that's throwing the perfect game, and it's, you know, in the ninth inning, and he's maybe facing his last batter, and the umpire makes a bad call and, you know, costs him his immortality in the game. That's the moment you would want to correct if at all possible. And I think we're trying to, in a similar way, you know, give the coaches a challenge flag, and hopefully if they use it, when they use it at that right moment, the video replay guys will replay guys will say, okay, clearly we missed it on the field, we'll correct it, and then you know, give the opportunity for the team that deserved to win to walk away with a victory.
Randy, there's already been a little pushback, if you want to call it that. Daron Carter, who made a catch for the ages last week for Saskatchewan, came out and said, if you use your challenge flag early in the game, what's to stop DBs from holding the rest of the game or doing that kind of thing? Do you worry about his concern in this matter?
Well, I would if we are not going to officiate the game after, you know, after the challenge flag is thrown, but we are going to officiate it. And to the credit of a number of our coaches and general managers, one of the things they asked us to do in implementing this change was to, you know, remind the officials that, you know, illegal contact downfield and pass interference, we need to be vigilant. We don't want to go back to a point where, you know, defensive backs are mugging our receivers. We don't want that in the game. You know, I think our fans would clearly say they love the wide open nature of the CFL, and we don't want to do anything to damage that. So, you know, what I would say to all of our receivers is that we're asking our officials to be vigilant, to call illegal contact and to call pass interference when it happens. And I'm confident that our officials will do that, and hopefully that fear will be we will find that it's we haven't created a second problem in correcting something that wasn't working.
If my time around the CFL has taught me anything, it's hard to get 9 general managers to agree on what to order for lunch, let alone it is to get a rule change, the same with either the ownership or the community ownership of clubs. How did you get this through a group that normally can't agree on what day of the week it is?
Well, you know, first of all, I can tell you in the very short time that I've been doing this, I have found, you know, whether it's the general managers or the club presidents or the board of governors to be a fantastic group to work with, and I've really enjoyed it. You know, what I did is I tried to come at this with logic. I presented the case. We did some real heavy lifting with with our competition committee. And we got our competition committee to make a unanimous recommendation to the team presidents. We had been in conversation with the team presidents. They were then voted in unanimously in favor of this change. And then we took that to our board of governors, and we had unanimous support for this as well. So I think each of those groups wants us to do the work. They want to know that when we're bringing something to them, that we're serious. And I'd say, you know, in these early days, I'm very, very proud to work with them. And I've hopefully established the kind of relationship with them that now that can last, you know, many, many years to come, where we have a responsible, respectful relationship with each other. But it was a good day it was a good process for me to go through. I'm obviously very pleased at the amount of support we got, in fact, and I think that is that's bodes well for the future.
With Randy Ambrosi, a commissioner of the CFL, this is Overdrive on TSN 1050 and the TSN Go app. I would suppose, Randy, you've talked to almost everybody about this, including officials. I'm not going to ask you to share information that maybe you're not comfortable with, but I'm wondering if there is data or if you have a sense, just in speaking to them or to general managers or to coaches or to players, was there a feeling that the officials at times would almost be reluctant to throw a flag, knowing that the challenge was the fallback, or vice versa?
Yeah, I don't think so. You know, the officiating is a very, very tough job. In fact, of all the things you might put in the category of thankless work, this may be one of the those that makes in the top three worldwide. It's hard to officiate. We all know that officials in every league at every level are criticized. The fact of the matter is, I think those people that do that work are professionals, and they live in the moment. And at that moment, they're, you know, staring into that pile of humanity, and I think they are driven by one thought, and then what did I see, and should I, you know, throw a flag? I would believe that all these extraneous things that we could talk about now are not a factor at that moment when they're considering what the right thing to do is.
Really appreciate your time today, Mr. Commissioner. Thanks for this, and we'll catch up again very soon, I hope.
I look forward to that. Thanks very much, guys.
Randy Ambrosi is the CFL Commissioner, and he joined us on the Maple Toyota Hotline. Red Tag Days are on now with 0% financing and lease rates on the Toyota Corolla and RAV4. Visit mapletoyota.ca.
It's one thing to make a rule change. It's another thing to make it during a season. It's a third thing in the craziness that is the Canadian Football League. Because historically, the CFL has not wanted a commissioner. By the CFL, I mean the individual teams. They want to operate individually. And it's always been the guy in central government. It's like being a crazy, you know, despot kind of situation, and you try and bring everybody together and you can't get it done. So the very fact that in the first month on the job, Randy Ambrosi's been able to put through a significant rule change and get clearance to do so from the crazy people out there is a real accomplishment. The world may not work out exceptionally well. It may not work out in his favor. I have some concerns about there being one challenge. That said, I give him great credit for being able to get it done in the environment of those crazy people.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing maybe we can bring up next time we talk to him too is this notion of, you know, booth challenges, right? The NFL and the inside the 2-minute warning at the end of halves will allow. Well, actually,
they have the touchdown. They have the touchdown.
The automatic touchdown challenge, automatic fumble challenge now, and if you're inside the final 2 minutes of the fourth quarter, the booth will call anything down if there's even any doubt, at least stop the game so they can check.
I don't like the pass interference challenge. I think that's subjective. Therefore, allow your official to do the job. If the official doesn't do the job, replace the official. That's the way I look at it. I like the challenges to be absolutely objective. Was he out of bounds? Is he in bounds? Did he make the catch? Did he not make the catch? Fumble, who's got the ball? Those kind of things.
What do you believe generally, Steve, about replay? Do you like where... I'm not talking specifically the CFL, because it's all over the place now, right? We've got the NHL, this offside stuff in the NHL. I just wanted to rip my hair out with this stuff, because... And I think we have to give each league its own grace period, right? There has to be some adjustments. But I'm looking at the National Hockey League and using the offside rule as an example. I don't give a crap if that guy's skate is on the ice and touching the blue line, or if it's slightly above the ice. If it is, what's the word? Perpendicular, adjacent? Help me here. Save me.
I'm an idiot. You're doing well.
Okay.
Perpendicular works fine.
Perpendicular, if it's running alongside the blue line, on the ice, off the ice, to me, you're onside. You're onside. But, of course, in the National Hockey League, if you're dragging it on the ice, it's onside. If you're above the ice, the puck goes in. After you're offside. I don't know how you can expect a human being to see that when the linesman is not at eye level with the ice, number one. And number two, you got to zoom these cameras in so far. I mean, it's no different than the pass interference challenge. It's a coach trying to have an effect on a particular play, especially if a goal is scored 30, 40 seconds later.
Especially if you go to the letter of the law of what pass interference actually is, then you're going to find it all the time, because those guys are jockeying with each other and their hands are on each other all the time. Offensive guys on defensive guys on offensive guys. I think the only sport that has this completely figured out is tennis. It's in or it's out.
Beep.
There's no questioning anything else. It's in or it's out. In baseball, it's not working to my satisfaction. In hockey, it's definitely not working to my satisfaction. In football, I don't really understand what you can challenge and what you can't, and why you can challenge certain things and why you can't challenge other things. The NFL is so complicated that it's hard to figure it all out. And in the CFL, I agree that it was getting out of control. That as Randy Ambrosi pointed out, the spirit of the rule was not what the coaches were looking for. The coaches, like in the Argo game the other day, they were looking for a guy blocking downfield on a pass. Well, the official didn't call it. He should have perhaps called it. He didn't. But in the end, it was looked at, and they threw out the challenge. But that's not something that should be challenged.
That's subjectivity again.
Again, it's subjectivity. That's where I think the next move the CFL should make is to remove the subjective calls from the challenges so that anything is... Although you can get to a point where a catch becomes a subjective thing. I don't believe it to be. Look at the Jays game the other night when Barney hits that fly ball to right field and the White Sox guys, you know, smash into it. It was a terrible
collision. That was ugly. Yep.
And the outfielder caught the ball. Unfortunately, the rule is that he has to transfer it to his hand for it to be a catch. Well, it was clear he caught the ball. No question about it. Came out after he was basically knocked unconscious. But the rule is such, it's a bad rule. The rule should be, did he catch it or didn't he catch it? And replay should have shown that. And they're looking up and everybody's seeing him make the catch, except in this case, sometimes you're caught because the rule's lousy.
What was a catch in football, Steve, in the National Football League when you were growing up, a young man watching that sport? We have turned. Is there anything more in life complicated than determining a tough catch in the National Football League? With the football process, and you must... you have to get both feet down, but if you have one elbow down, if you're coming down on your side, one elbow's good enough, but one foot isn't. Like, it's
Here's what drives me batty. You're a running back, and you're running in from the one-yard line, and you jump in the air, and you cross the goal line with the ball, and you come down, and the ball hits the thing, and the ball, or somebody knocks the ball out, and the ball goes flying, but you've already scored your touchdown.
Well, you can knock it out mid-air. As long as he's crossed the plane with control, it's a touchdown.
But if you're a wide receiver, and you jump up, and you're in bounds, and you catch the ball, and then you fall out of bounds, and hit the ground, and then the ball falls out, that's incomplete. What's the difference?
Well, yeah. I have no answer to that question.
That's what drives me crazy. It's not what's objective in that case. It's what does the rules say? And this whole thing about having the ball and then making a football play or whatever, that extra step you have to take. I think, you know, football's got...
That was all off the Kelvin Johnson thing in Chicago, 5-6 years ago.
The NFL has a problem still in determining, you know, I think... what is a catch, what isn't a catch, and what is pass interference, and what isn't pass interference.
It just feels like there are a bunch of faces we'd never recognize, off in a room somewhere, and the league, and I'm coming down more on the NFL here, I'm sure it's prevalent in all these major sports.
But I think they're the worst.
The NFL is the worst. It's like, we got to give these guys something to do. So we need to invent phrases like the process of completing a catch. You know, did he break the plane? Did he this? Did he that?
Here's the process of completing the catch. The ball is in your hand.
Right.
That's the process.
Now, they did eliminate, about a decade ago, right, the subjectivity. If you went up and you made a catch, but you got pushed out of bounds by the defensive back, it used to be that the sideline judge could determine, well, he would have come down in bounds, therefore it's a catch, had he not been pushed out. Well, they eliminated that now. You can just push a guy out of bounds, and if he doesn't come down with both feet, which is, you know, per physics, impossible in a lot of those cases. It's just an automatic incompletion.
Here's what got me nuts during the Stanley Cup final. Nashville has the puck crossing the line and apparently, is it Nashville? Yeah. Apparently goes offside, but there's no call. And they turn the puck over. Pittsburgh then turns it back to them. They come in and score. The goal is disallowed because the original guy, after looking at the replay 97 times, was offside. And David Poyle, I wrote about him the next day. He said he spent the whole night watching, stayed up all night basically, watching the replay over and over. And he said, I still haven't seen offside yet. You have to look at a play 50 times or 100 times or how many times to determine whether it's offside or not offside. You've already made your decision.
Right.
It's a play that stands because of the way the rule... You have to give a little bit of leverage to the officials. If they can't see it and you have to slow it down and watch it over and over and over again and you're still not completely convinced, then you have to make a call, then you've already made the call. The call is play stands. And that's what they need to do. They need to use logic a little more. It's like the play, you know, when the one with the goalie catches the puck and you know it's in the net?
But yes.
But you can't see the puck. You can't see it. So visually, you can't see the puck, but he's holding it.
Yeah, but like you don't know if the whole thing went over the line or not, right? Because it depends on where it is in his mitt.
But if his arm is like back of the, okay, of the net, you know that the puck is in there, but guess what? You can't see it. No goal. Drives me crazy. Illogic. At least what Randy Ambrosi has done in a very short time in the Canadian Football League is he said, I'm rolling my sleeves up here, guys.
I'm getting involved.
I'm getting in. I'm going to see what's going on in the game. I'm going to fix things that I think need to be fixed. You may not agree with me, but I'm doing this in the best interest of this league and this game and trying to make things better. And I think that's a fresh and fine attitude for a guy who's only a few weeks on the job.
Generally speaking, the imperfection of sport, specifically when it comes down to umpires, referees, officials of any kind, it makes for great water cooler talk. Steve, I mean... My team wouldn't have lost the World Series in Game 7 if such and such hadn't happened. Or Dallas maybe would have won that playoff game in Green Bay a couple of years ago if that Dez Bryant play had been ruled a catch.
If you want to get somebody going who's been around this town a long time, ask about the triple play from the World Series in 92.
Oh, God.
There are people to this day who are angry that they got cheated out of history with Kelly Gruber and Devon White, and what a wonderful whole thing that was, and the tag on Deion Sanders at second base, and you know it looked like it was a triple play,
right?
Was it Davidson?
The umpire?
Yeah.
Bob Davidson? Could have been. Yeah, so. That's. I'm not remembering.
I'm trying to remember correctly, but people will still argue that.
Fergie said, yes, it was Bob Davidson, the umpire? Yeah.
That's why we love Fergie.
Yeah. Well, he's...
He just throw it a baseball
encyclopedia in there.
Yeah, you just get it back.
Well, I think we'll bring Fergie on a little bit later on in the program because we'll get back into the Stroman and Tim Anderson stuff from last night and just some of the personalities that we've seen here over the years, and Jose Bautista and Marcus Stroman are two of them who play on the edge. Fergie definitely would remember Dave Steeb. You would too. You would have covered Dave Steeb back in the day.
It's funny, in one of my last confrontations of sorts with Dave Steeb, because usually you didn't have normal conversations with him. You know, usually they were... And
he was argumentative, or he was giving you that 1,000-yard stare?
He gave you the stare, but he was difficult. If you didn't ask a good question, he stared at you like you were... like one of the great idiots that ever lived. Like when somebody made an error behind him, for example. But this day, he had come back from an injury, and they had like a 3:30 availability with him. And for whatever reason, I couldn't make the 3:30 availability. I was late, some traffic, something happened. So I'm there at 4 o'clock, and I walk into the clubhouse, and there's Dave Steeb at his locker by himself. And I walk up, and he's like, what do you want? Like, it was a half an hour ago. What do you want? And I said, 500 words. I'll write the rest. And he laughed, and we had a good talk after that. And
there you go.
But you had to go right back at him, or else he owned you.
Yeah. And you got to catch him at the right time.
Yes.
Too.
Which was very rarely.
All right. Coming up on the other side, and we will get into some more Steve Stroman, Bautista chatter. We'll get Scotty Ferguson in here before the program's out. But on the other side... Steve Bartman has a World Series ring from the Chicago Cubs. Don't know if you remember this. It was one of the epic 30 for 30s back in 2011. Steve Bartman catching hell. Wayne Drays was the man behind it. He writes for ESPN, the magazine. He's going to join us next. We're going to do the Bartman follow-up. Stay with us. This is Overdrive, TSN 1050 and the TSN Go app. We'll be right back. This is Overdrive, TSN 1050. You're streaming us on the TSN Go app. Scott MacArthur for Brian Hayes, Post Media's and TSN's The Reporter, Steve Simmons, with you this afternoon. Steve Phillips, Jim Popp in the 6 o'clock hour. But, man, this is a human interest story that's going unbelievably on a decade and a half now. Steve Bartman, who was so unfairly vilified for what befell the Chicago Cubs in the 2003 National League Championship Series. And Steve, you know me. I do not hide my Cubs fandom. Alex Gonzalez, who we watched play here, one of the best defensive shortstops of his generation, kicking that double play ground ball. That's what happened in the top of the eighth inning that night in Game 6 of the NLCS. But Bartman had to wear it. Well, he kind of disappeared, and he was the subject of a 30 for 30 on ESPN, subject of a lot of articles. He's just kind of fallen off the face of the earth. Well, now, in a way, he's reemerged. The Chicago Cubs have presented him with a World Series ring. And to discuss that and whatever it is we know about Steve Bartman now, some 14 years after the incident at Wrigley Field, we welcome to the program from ESPN the magazine, Wayne Drays. Wayne, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you? Good afternoon.
It's great to have you on. Okay, so Steve Bartman gets a World Series ring. To your understanding, how did this come about? Because this is a guy, Bartman, who has avoided publicity at all costs. So to kind of come out of his shell to receive this ring is something, isn't it?
It is, for sure. And I think, you know, from what I understand, it generated from the Cubs and the Ricketts family that owns the Cubs wanting to reach out to him and kind of let him know that, for one, he's off any hook that he might still think he's on. And number two, in an interesting way, kind of wrap their arms around him and give him a big hug and say, you know, it's okay. You know, we took care of this. You don't need to worry about this anymore and go on and live your life.
But don't you think winning the World Series kind of to the side anyhow? I wonder myself, if I'm a player, for example, on this Chicago Cubs team and I just won the World Series, I'm not sure I'd be all that comfortable with some guy from the past getting the same ring I got.
Well, they gave the ring to every single member of the front office, just about anybody who is within arm's reach of touching the Cubs got one of those $40,000 rings, if you will. So I mean, it's not quite that exclusive, we'll put it that way. But I think, look, the players today, certainly, I'm not sure if they care or not, but this was a major chapter in Cubs history. And the part of this that fascinates me is at some point the Cubs had the discussion with Steve Bartman, hey, we want to do this. He accepts, and then he's willing to, you know, come out of the dark in this statement, which, you know, we haven't heard from him since, you know, I interviewed him several years ago, and then his statement the morning after the game. So the decision of him to accept this, you know, put out the very eloquent words that he did on Monday afternoon. It's been very, very interesting to me.
How many years after the October 2003 night, Wayne, did you speak to him?
If I'm not mistaken, it's been a while, but I think it was the next. If it wasn't 2004, then it was 2005, the next season, and it was, they had a weekend series with the Red Sox. And you know, as I explained in the 30 for 30, you know, my editor gave me this assignment to go find Steve Bartman. And, you know, to this day, I've worked at ESPN as a writer at the magazine and the website for 18 years now. To this day, it's still the most challenging, difficult, uncomfortable assignment I ever had. You know, sitting in a parking lot waiting for some guy to emerge to basically, you know, jump out of a car and ask him a few questions. And much, you know, I'm also a lifelong diehard Cubs fan, which is one of the reasons, you know, this editor gave me that assignment. He knew that I would handle it with care. At the same time, you know, it made me absolute a wreck. So, you know, and look, you know, all these years later, you know, I've heard from several folks that, you know, the Bartman family and Steve himself are less than thrilled with my antics that day and with the story and with the 30 for 30. You know, as sympathetic as it was to Steve, they think everybody should sort of look the other way. And even if you look at his statement on Monday, you know, he had a few words in there about the media, you know, respecting privacy and things like that. Well, I know pretty darn well where that's directed. So, and I get it. You know, I understand where if the role was reversed and people were, you know, showing up on my doorstep or in my parking lot where I worked, I wouldn't have been thrilled about it either.
Okay, yeah. So he didn't agree to meet you then?
No, he didn't. No, it was totally...
But he spoke to you.
Yeah, go ahead.
But he spoke to you after...
He did.
He didn't just blow you off and go into his office or whatever the case.
No, he actually had words. Right. I introduced myself and told him who I was, and I said, I want to ask you, you know, for an interview. And I said, I know this isn't, you know, the best way to do that, but, you know, we're not having any success getting a hold of you, and I want to, you know, ask you for an interview. And I gave him my card. And then, you know, before I left, it was a real quick exchange, maybe a minute or two. You know, we talked about the game that day against the Red Sox. And the last thing I said to him is I said, I want to apologize on behalf of Cub fans. I think it sucks that you've had to go through. I think it's unfair. And he said, you know, thank you. He took my card. And the last thing he said to me, I'll never forget what he said he was going to check with his legal team and get back to me. And his last words were, you know, just so you know, for future reference, not the best way to ask for an interview jumping out of a car in a parking lot. And I said, I respect that. And I left, and that was it.
Well, everyone in the business that I know, and I've been in newspapers 37 years now, has been sitting in a parking lot at one time in their career and waiting for someone. And it's not something that you take lightly, and it's not something you really want to do, but it becomes part of an assignment or part of your story. When you do that, and then you have to put the story together, and then you have to write it, when you see the final product, what are your thoughts then?
Well, you know, it's funny. When I wrote the piece, it's one of the few pieces I've written at ESPN that was sent back to me, and I was told it was total garbage, the first draft. My editor said, you know, basically, stop beating around the bush and write with the emotion, the passion that you had for that team and that you had in that moment. And so I kind of shoved all my reservations aside and just wrote. And I wrote the piece in a couple hours. It just kind of poured out of me. And they absolutely loved it. And so, you know, I still was kind of having those reservations. And when you see it, it's, you know, it's weird. It's awkward. It's uncomfortable sometimes, you know, and then, you know, a few years later, ESPN decides they're going to make a movie and have, you know, my story in the parking lot be a decent chunk of that film. You know, that's strange too. It's strange to have one of the things I've been, you know, I'm known about in my career at ESPN being, you know, stalking this Cubs fan who, you know, had a little bit of bad luck at an important game.
Wayne Dres is with us on Overdrive from ESPN, the magazine, and he's with us on the Maple Toyota Hotline. One of the most fascinating things, and it was detailed well in the 30 for 30 piece back 6 years ago, Wayne, is this guy's ability in a major market, in a city where that baseball team, the Cubs, is so much a part of the fabric. Even White Sox fans have to admit that. This guy's ability to be incognito, does it amaze you at how he has been able to stay under the radar over the last 14 years? And if you have any knowledge of this, to your understanding, how far has he had to go to not be traced or tracked?
Yeah, that is absolutely incredible. That in this era, you know, we have now of Twitter, Snapchat, Facebook, everybody is walking around with a camera in their pocket. The fact that we have never had anybody snap a photo or anything or say they've seen Steve Bartman or anything is mind-boggling. I can tell you that I know, you know, in the first day after after this happened, you know, there was a message that went out at the accounting firm where he worked, imploring everybody to kind of leave him alone, keep their mouth shut. If I'm not mistaken, there were some words that if, you know, anybody talked to the media or, you know, they were caught saying anything about Steve anywhere, they were going to lose their job on the spot. You know, I understand there were people that would come into there, come into that place for interviews and would perhaps going to be come across him, and they were told the same thing. You know, you say a word or anything, you lose your job. Now, I will say this. When I met Steve that day in the parking lot, I wouldn't say that he, you know, looked like a different person than he did that night on TV at Wrigley. But if you weren't looking for him, it would have been easy to overlook him. Remember, he had the headphones and the Cubs hat pulled real low, and you know, the I think Renegades baseball sweatshirt. I mean, he was, you know, he's like any of us going to a baseball game in the middle of October. He's trying to keep warm. And the day I saw him was a summer day, and I think he was in, like, you know, slacks and a polo. You know, his hair looked, you know, different than what I sort of expected it under the cap. And so, you know, in that regard, I don't think it would be that easy for folks to identify him. But, you know, I can tell you, I know he's been back to Wrigley Field. I know he's been back there even for an event this year. So he's managed to live his life and go about it. And I think what it speaks to is the type of person he is, the type of friends he has, that the people close to him have rallied around him, supported him, and not said a word, you know, elsewhere.
Wayne, I'm a big time Cubs fan. I don't hide it. I have been for 30 years. I remember 03 like it was yesterday. And I identify two things from the top of that eighth inning more than Bartman having an effect on the result of that game. The botched tailor-made double play ground ball that Alex Gonzalez kicked, and then the fact that you could argue Dusty Baker left Mark Pryor in the game too long. And that's something that probably would not happen here in 2017 with the emphasis on bullpens. Oh, and then, by the way, they could have won Game 7. They had another chance. So why do you think it was that Steve Bartman wore this?
I think there's two reasons. Number one, I think the reaction of Moises Alou. I think the way he slammed his glove on his leg, you know, pointed at the stands, he was essentially telling everyone in the Wrigley Field, everyone watching, you know, around the world on TV, I would have had this ball and it was his fault. Now, whether or not that's true, that was the message that sort of reaction sent. And of course, your diehard in that moment is going to, you know, lean on the message of the player and attack or be frustrated with that fan. Now, the second part of it, in my opinion, always was, look, Steve was not the most intimidating guy sitting there, right? I've always said if this was a, you know, a 6'3", 280-pound Chicago fireman, it might have been a bit of a different story. But when people start coming at him and, you know, throwing stuff and screaming and yelling, he just sort of, you know, kind of sits there and reverts into his shell. Well, that's, you know, that's as simple as people who were jerks in high school, you know, picking on kids. And I think that's what it was at the same time. Is here's this individual who's in this situation, and that's an easy target. He's not going to necessarily, you know, fight back, if you will. And it speaks a lot about our culture, our society, about people, the way we treat each other, that, you know, that was the way, you know, people chose to respond and treat somebody who, quite frankly, in that moment, you know, he needed a hug and probably a cold beer.
Last one for you. You delayed open heart surgery so that you could stick with the Cubs through the World Series. Is that true?
That's 100% true, yes.
So this wasn't life or death then, obviously. You wouldn't have taken it that far?
No, it was. I mean, I asked the doctor, and he said, you need to get in here as soon as possible, but if you want to wait till the World Series is over, it shouldn't be the end of the world. We'll put it that way.
You guys should get a room.
Yeah, right. But I'll tell you, I mean, Game 7 was surreal watching that. You know, in fact, I mean, I knew I was having surgery Monday after the World Series when the division series started. I looked at the calendar. That's when Game 7 would potentially be if the Cubs made it that far. And so I scheduled my surgery. And so as the playoffs went along and the Cubs, you know, kept winning and advancing, not only was it getting closer and closer to the sort of lifelong dream I've had of the Cubs winning the World Series, but every day was drawing closer to, you know, me laying on a table at the Cleveland Clinic having my chest opened up. And Game 7 was certainly that way. It was the highest of highs, and yet, you know, still the reality of knowing that Monday morning at whatever it was, 8 o'clock, I was going to go through something pretty darn serious.
Glad you're doing well now, my friend. Thanks for this, Wayne. Hope to have you on again.
Awesome. Appreciate it. You guys take care.
You bet. Wayne Drays of ESPN, the magazine. Steve Bartman gets his World Series ring. Wayne joined us on the Maple Toyota Hotline. Red Tag Days are on now. With 0% financing and lease rates on the Toyota Corolla and RAV4, visit mapletoyota.ca. And if you were wondering, Steve, although I doubt you were, yes, I will be at Wrigley in the crowd for the Cubs-Jays
World Series?
Later this week.
Oh.
Or, sorry, later this month.
I thought you meant Cubs-Jays World Series whenever that happens.
One of those two teams has a shot this year.
Yeah, they start.
I don't think either does.
You don't? I think the Cubs do. They're starting to come. They're playing the kind of baseball they played last year. Now, it's taken this long for them to get it going. Now you've got the Dodgers, the Cubs, Nationals. Boy, the National League playoffs. I mean, I think both playoffs this year really have a certain quality to them that they haven't had in a while. When you see what Houston's doing, you see what the Yankees and Red Sox have, and you look at Cleveland's got to get it together in a short series with that bullpen.
Yeah. Big cities, right? New York, if the Yankees make it, the Cubs there, L.A. Dodgers, the big cities.
Chicago, L.A., Boston, baseball's going to love that.
It will.
Don't have to put Toronto on at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
There you go. Jim Popp, Argos general manager at 6:40. Steve Phillips, TSN Blue Jays and MLB insider at 6 o'clock. Stay with us for Overdrive. It continues, TSN 1050, the TSN Go app. I don't know how much we want to read into this, but I think we're all keenly aware of the sensitivities of the Buffalo sports fan. So, and this is coming from ProFootballTalk.com, Mike Florio. Here's the deal. So, as we know, three NFL teams have relocated in the last 2 years or so. Bills owner Terry Pegula made it clear that folks in Buffalo shouldn't worry yet. Now, here's the quote. Quote, well, we have a lease through 2023, so that's a contractual obligation. That's my stance on it. This is 2017, so we've got a long way to go before we start worrying about anything besides where we're at now. End quote. Asked later about an out clause in the lease that's triggered in 2018, Pegula said this, quote, where are we going to go? End quote.
That's San Diego? No. Here's the game that every NFL owner plays.
They do need a stadium.
This is what it's always about. Build me a stadium, or I'm taking my toys and I'm going home. And that's the way they play that game. How many years in Minnesota has somebody been threatening to move the Minnesota Vikings somewhere? I mean, once in a while, the Raiders have been playing this game forever. And finally, they're going to Las Vegas eventually. But I think that's what you're seeing here, is that they're playing this, you know, build me a new stadium or fix my stadium more than it needs to be fixed now kind of thing.
The Chargers played that game and they backed themselves into being the second tenant in Stan Kroenke's new massive joint.
I have a new name for them, by the way. They're the Los Angeles Chargers of Anaheim.
The Los Angeles.
That's what I've decided to call them now. I can never get used to teams moving. I mean, I'm still having troubles with Baltimore no longer. The Baltimore Colts no longer being
Baltimore.
That's
before my time. But
and that was my team. You talk about being a Cubs fan. The Colts were my team as a kid. And from that day on, I've never had an NFL team, really, that I call my own. I watch a lot of football, and I love football. But I've never had that one team that was my guys because they broke my heart, and that was it.
Yeah, my San Francisco 49ers haven't been the same since they moved to Santa Clara.
Since they let Kaepernick go.
Yeah, there you go. Jim Popp, Argos general manager at 6:40. Steve Phillips, TSN Blue Jays insider, with us next. Hour number 3 of Overdrive starts in moments on TSN 1050 and the TSN Go app.